It's time for the movie raid, and tonight's victim is actor Patrick Gilmore, that played in several films such as 2012, The Cabin in the Woods, such as 12 Rounds 2, and countless others, as well as television. Hello.
How you doing?
What's going on?
Not a lot. Back in Vancouver to do a little work, and happy to be back, though. So I was in LA for a bit, and the heat was just getting to me.
How is the jobs over there, anyway? Are you getting a lot better jobs there than you do anywhere else?
In Vancouver?
Yes.
Than anywhere else, you mean? Well, it's kind of an odd thing. I've been in Vancouver for, I guess, 12 years. So you kind of build a base. You start out here in a no one, and over 12 years, the casting directors get to know you, the filmmakers get to know you. And then moving to a new city like L.A., which is, you know, the idea to open up more opportunities, you're basically starting from the ground up again. No one knows you. None of the people that in production know you. So you gotta swallow your pride and start again. But coming back here, you know, it's like coming home. You know, you know everybody. You see all your friends in the audition room. So, it feels good. You know, it's a little, it's like comfort food.
Yeah, I mean, it could be different for everybody as far as the acting perspective, because some people prefer the foreign market, so it's like anything, just because either it generates better money on the, like, especially the independent area.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the ideal. Is, you know, I've got friends that are present in the Toronto market and LA, and, you know, I don't know what my ideal is yet, but I'd like to try other markets just to see, you know, where I feel most comfortable, and if I have the opportunity to get on some bigger shows in the States, or even break into some independent film market in the U.S., then absolutely. Because what ends up happening with actors in Vancouver is, as booming as the industry can be, there is a ceiling. You see actors hit it. You start playing the same roles and going out for the same parts, working with the same people, and it gets, as a disparaging remark about Vancouver, if you're lucky, it gets repetitious. If it's lucky, you work for every director, but, you know, work on every show. I haven't hit that, but I start to feel myself kind of repeating roles or going out for the same parts, and I think, you know what, I'm young enough, I've got the time, I have the opportunity, let's see what else I can do in the States, as well as, you know, maintaining a career here.
You're almost like just finding yourself, because you're playing a specific role in countless, let's say, sci-fi films. You're playing like this alien type creature, you're playing as this villain, or when it comes to horror films, you could be a slasher for a couple films and just see where exactly are you at. And it does go down to the point, where do you fit in?
Creatively, what do you want to start playing? And I come from a city in Canada called Edmonton. I don't know if you know Canadian geography very well, but Edmonton, even if you haven't heard of it, it has one of the richest theater communities in North America. Their Fringe Festival is the second biggest in the world. And so that's my doorway into acting, was this rich theater community. And in theater, I started off playing, you know, you play a girl, you know, in a Shakespearean role, playing a 100-year-old man or a little boy or a married man or a knight, all like in a complete range, and you're stretching these muscles. And then you get into film and television, and I'm auditioning for guy next door, deputy, guy next door, man with beard, you know, and you're not really stretching those muscles anymore. And so there are different places you want to hit, different milestones in your career, and being able to get out of those opening roles that are you initially go for, that's exciting. Is, you know, when you get a role to play a villain, oh, I've never played a villain before, oh, here's a role where I die, or here's a role where I'm the main villain, here's the romantic lead, and I don't feel like I've explored all my range yet. I don't think any actor has. I mean, if you talk to them, if they're honest, there are roles that they've never got that they'd love to, but so I don't know where I fit in, and I don't think a lot of actors do. If they do, they're lucky.
There are actors that would even go back to regretting, like, in the early days when they first start out. Of course, no one would know if this role would be a huge role. And then they regret it later because they turned it down. And that's kind of seems like a problem in some ways. Instead of just taking whatever role that you could get and try to make the best out of it as you possibly could, whether you sink or swim, so to speak, you got to at least try for it.
Yeah, and I think that's a luxury of an actor at my stage, is that I'm not really well known, and so I can make colossal mistakes, and you know, only a few people are going to see it. You know, maybe my parents, or, you know, God forbid, a casting director.
Do you think actors should be more involved as far as building the character rather than, of course, just being set up for the character?
Well, that's on a case-to-case basis. I've worked with directors who, you know, they've created this project from the ground up, and they have a really precise view of what they want. And so you kind of stick to their vision. I know you run into a problem of then, you know, of being just a prop. And the reason why you hire certain actors is that they're bringing something to the role. They have something to offer, and it becomes a collaboration. So it's varying degrees. I mean, some of the most fun is when they the directors don't know what they're doing, and they allow you to do whatever you want. Granted, then it becomes like a band with five lead singers, and it becomes a mess. But if you're working with great actors, it becomes a nice balance. Yeah, I don't like the idea of an actor not being able to bring anything to it. I mean, you know, film and television, like I said, it's collaborative. They have to bring something to an extent, I guess. I don't know. It's such a case-to-case basis, but one of the things that for actors that are just coming up is to have that confidence in yourself to say, you know what, I was hired for a reason. I do have a talent. I'm here. I should be able to contribute and be creative as well, and not just say, where do I stand? What do I say? What would you like? You know, that's especially for Canadian actors, that's a tough thing. We're just too damn polite.
Well, where do you think the sole focus should be at when playing a role? Where do you, or as far as the energy goes, when playing a role, where do you think the sole focus would be?
This is going to sound so Hallmark, but the sole focus should be on the truth. If you're playing something farcical, I mean, there's wiggle room, sitcoms and what have you, but whenever I approach a role, you know, I get the script, I kind of get the beats down, I read it, and you start from somewhere that is truthful to the character and to what's bookending these moments, if that makes any sense. One of the things I love going, whenever you play a villain, the best way to approach playing a villain is that while you're playing him, he's not a villain. He's right in what he's doing, and find the truth in that. Why are you doing this? Why are you doing what people are considering is evil? I think that makes a more interesting evil or a villain. But I think that these are good questions, by the way. You're right. This is making me think. I thought I'd put up my feet and go, well, I don't know. Yes, now I have to actually voice these things. But yeah, I think it's just, I think that people will respond to you better as an actor if they don't see you acting, if they don't see you faking it, if they don't feel they're being duped. If you come at it truthfully, they're along for the ride with you. There's a suspension of disbelief that comes with every project, every film or television project. And if you can narrow that gap that the audience has to jump to, it makes the viewing experience so much more enjoyable. They can go along with the ride. Yeah, if you can make it as close to the truth as possible, people believe it. It's like they say, when you're telling a lie, base the lie off the truth, so you can keep track of your lies and people will believe it. But I guess that's very similar to filmmaking.
Even the smallest details matters, man. It, when that character is just sipping a cup of coffee, the way that person is sipping that cup of coffee, that's part of the character. It's not just, okay, you're just picking up because you're picking it up. You have to tell it, man. You have to tell the whole story, everything about this character, so they know. I don't want to be dragged into the story. I don't want to just, oh, okay, he doesn't look like he's doing much of anything.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you don't want to have to buy into anything. You just have to, you want to be able to just immediately accept it. One of the first little things, I sometimes do this, but when I first started acting, and I thought this was such a revolutionary form of studying acting, was I would be out in public at a restaurant or cafe, and I would just point out somebody to myself who was, you know, with a group or by themselves, and I would say to myself, this person here is on camera, let's say, and he is the best actor in the world because he is 100% truthful. So what is he doing that's making him so believable? What are these little idiosyncrasies, these little movements, the way his eyes dart about the room, the way he drinks that cup of coffee? That's the most natural way someone does, because he is being natural. But if a camera's on him, like, how would someone replicate that?
Yeah, as much as like a finger twitch or something. See, that's a part of that character. It's not you. It's like, that's how that person might have some kind of a disorder.
That person, exactly, yeah. And so, and it's a fun game for me to play, and I'm sure other actors have versions of this. And you can pick anybody. You can pick, you know, a homeless person off the street. You can pick the, you know, the woman walking her dog. What is she doing that is so signature her and yet 100% truthful? And maybe it's not. Maybe she's putting it on. She sees some guys looking at her across the street, so she, you know, puffs up her chest, or the guy sucks in his gut. You know, people are fascinating. People watching is one of the best acting classes ever. And again, it all comes down to truth.
Yeah, and observation and that, you combine those two, it's like, you know, you've learned something more than you ever could when it comes to acting in this role, because it all comes down to that little detail. If you can make that little detail work and just not sense a falseness, that you got it nailed, man.
Yeah, because it, t- take something as small as, you know, not having any weight in your suitcase when you pick it up, and it throws people completely out of the movie. It's something very small, and I think that's where some of the best performances are. Whether they're consciously happening or not, it's got to be real.
Yeah, and in terms of the film industry, do you think it kind of lost some of its attractiveness? Because you see, of course, you got the whole hot girl and the muscular guy in a lot of films and commercials and this and that, but you see a lot of production going, but it's just a bunch of pretty faces here and there without actually putting some work into a story or into the acting stuff. Because I see a lot of one-sided characters. It's like, I'm not getting it.
You're just saying just kind of they're not putting the work into the characterization, and they're just kind of going for a glossy market appeal? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's, definitely mainstream stuff has kind of gone that way. I mean, there just seems to be every decade a different revolution, whether it's the, you know, Clerks, you know, independent revolution, now it's the Netflix and the cable TV revolution. You know, and of course, before that, there was the YouTube, you know. I mean, it's all Kickstarter. I mean, we're inundated right now with so many different ways of the girl in her parents' garage making a film. Everyone has access to make a movie. Some might argue too much because, you know, we're inundated with short films and Vines and Instagrams and YouTube of anybody and anyone making a short film or a TV show or a web series. But what that does do is it challenges the people, the mainstream, the people that had the flagship restaurant in town, you know, and they've been serving the same stuff, and now it's becoming more silicone-injected and Handsome Dan-infused style of art. It's challenging them to become a little more, I don't want to harp on this real stuff, but in the 60s and 70s, I don't know if you would have, like, a Hollywood star like Owen Wilson or Paul Giamatti. You know, I mean, these are real character faces and some of the best actors that we have to offer. I should have come up with a better list of these character people. I think, here's a perfect example. Lena Dunham, probably one of the, you know, she jokes that she's the voice of the generation. And because of independent money and because of the opportunity that arises in the acceptance of artists for their art, she's influencing so many filmmakers. But because of, you know, her physicality, there's a chance maybe two decades ago that we'd never hear of a Lena Dunham. So I don't know, I don't know if I agree that it's becoming more and more plastic. Maybe a small, you know, maybe the big three studio style movie, you know, we got to appeal to kids. What's the next sci-fi Harry Potter Hunger Games thing, you know, and they chalk it full of, there was a movie recently where it was like Beauty and the Beast. It was a remake of that. I don't know if you remember this.
Oh, I do. I know exactly what you're talking about.
I never saw it, but I just howled because the poster was like, oh, she's, you know, she's the damsel in distress, and he's the ugly beast.
Yes.
The most handsome son of a bitch, and they put a little scar on his face, and he's like, oh, he's hideous.
I didn't get it. I was like, really? It's just didn't get plastic surgery or something, dude.
Yeah, you're good. Yeah, it actually makes it more attractive. You look rugged. I think that as much as that has all the money behind it, there is way too much independent film that can inspire people to go out and do whatever they want. And I think that they're the ones that are going to win. Art is the artist rather than the aesthetic appeal of Barbie doll.
Yeah, and then there's the whole supergroup films when they have these very well-known actors, and even if the smallest film, such as like a kid's film, that's not animated, I mean, they'll throw this actor and this actor and this actor and this actor that's very well-known in the industry that everybody knows, but it takes it away from the story, in my opinion, because the fact that...
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I want to see actors I have never seen. I want to see actors I've never seen before, and then it's cool to see a well-known actor in there. That's cool. It's a cameo or something like that. But I'm more interested in seeing what this particular actor has to offer that I've never seen before.
Well, not only that, but like I know exactly what you're talking about, and I haven't really watched a lot of animated films in the last few years, but I remember when they did Horton Hears a Who. You know, I love Dr. Seuss. I'm going to go watch this. But what it was a Jim Carrey vehicle. And he got to do his Arnold Schwarzenegger impersonation, and he did this, and he got to go crazy. I don't want to go, I want to see Horton Hears a Who. I want to go see Dr. Seuss. Disney was really good there for a while of doing, I guess it was kind of Disney and the DreamWorks, and Disney would have the, you know, this, you know, fueled by the story and the music, and then they'd have DreamWorks, which would be like, you know, Jack Black is this, you know, Kung Fu Panda or whatever. But yeah, every time I recognize the voice, for the most part, it totally bumps me. I want to get lost in the character and the story. Like I know that these are actors with names, but like Frozen, for instance, it was a huge hit. I'm sure there were notable actors in it, but I can't, none that bumped me to the point where that's all I heard was, you know, Angelina Jolie's voice throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, that share the same shows on a network, on the same network, I'm not going to say the name, but they'll have the same exact actors doing the same type roles in every single show of this network, and I hate it because...
Right.
I'm tired of hearing the same ones, man. Let's get some more different people in there.
So, sure.
But they want to cut down on the money-wise because they've already paid a lot of money just to have these guys on. Animated is becoming, or has been becoming, successful in terms of viewership. Everyone is going toward that rather than seeing actual films these days. Do you think film, the industry should actually take a little bit of notes on this? Because you see how well you get so entranced in the animated ones now.
I think mainstream film can learn a lot from Pixar. I'm sure you've heard this 1,000 times, but you know, there are movies that go on for 2 hours that don't make you cry, and the first 5 minutes of the movie Up had everyone and their, you know, their brother bawling their eyes out. Pixar, they're magic makers. There's something precise about the way they do it. It's not calculated. I mean, it's not like they're pulling on our strings. They're really crafting beautiful visually and emotional stories. But I can't say that I've watched a lot of animation. I mean, I remember Saturday morning cartoons. There was like maybe 20 different ones, and I could maybe name five, whether it was Rocket Robin Hood or Battle of the Planets. But I mean, there's so many cartoons now, and there's so many comic books that I can't keep up. I have no idea where they stand quality-wise and what they could possibly offer film and television. It's sensory overload across the board.
Yeah, it's very overwhelming. But, you know, everybody knows that when it comes to the film, you'll have your films that make very, very good money and successful, and then you get the ones that bomb due to either lack of promotion, lack of writing, that the characters are just not fitting right. How would you deal with this type of failure if you're involved in one of these films?
Yes, I'm sure I've been involved in many of them. I don't know. I mean, I think it would mean a lot more to me if I was, you know, if I had written it or directed it. But as an actor, you know, at my level, you know, you go out and you play ball and you do the best that you can and you walk away. If it fails, God willing, it's not because of my performance. Yeah, and I think maybe that's why I've always hesitated to, you know, I've written some and I've directed and written some, like, sketch comedy stuff for YouTube or little short films here and there, but it's that idea of creating something even bigger for a wider audience and then presenting it to everyone. It's like a sacrificial lamb. It's like, you know, here's something I've created and you put it in the middle of a group of hungry individuals and see if they tear it apart and if they enjoy it, or if that scares me. And so people who step out and do that, I mean, I applaud their the calories they burn and the energy put into it, but also just the courage to put something they really believe in out there. I've never been super invested in that's a horrible thing to say. I think the nicer way of saying it is I'm really invested in what I've contributed. The rest is completely out of my hands. The editing, the music, the coloring, the directing. And so if it's a failure, you know, it's unfortunate, but I guess that's just part of it. Yeah, unless you're the mother and father of the beast.
Well, go ahead and plug in anything that you'd like to promote, any websites or what other projects you got going on or that's about to come out or go to DVD or whatever.
Well, I'm currently appearing in Grace Point on Fox, and that's the remake of the British show Broadchurch, and I have a very small role in it. I mean, you know, you'll see me in the background maybe once or twice, but it's one of these shows. I was such a fan of Broadchurch, so I'm just thrilled to be part of this show, and it's one of these water cooler shows. People are going to be talking about it, so that's exciting. I'm doing an episode of Arrow that should air any minute now, any day now. Yeah, it's constant. Like I said to you before, before recording, I had to look at IMDb. I'm not sure what's out or what I've done, and you've seen things that I've never seen, like 12 Rounds Were Loaded. Never seen it. I forgot that I did it. I should really go back and make sure I didn't ruin that film, like we were just talking about. No, I mean, you can always find me on Twitter. That's kind of where I live. My Twitter handle is @PatrickGilmore. I tend to make an ass out of myself on that on a daily basis.
Well, there you go. That's actor Patrick Gilmore.